ಬಿಹಾರಿ ಗೋಪಿ ಜನ ವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವಾರಧಾರಿ ಮಾಧವ ಸಿಂಗ ಬಿಹಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ಬಿಹಾರಿ ಗೋಪಿ ಜನ ವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವಾರಧಾರಿ ಯಶೋದನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಶೋದನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನ ತೀರ ವನ ಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರ ವನ ಚಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ಬಿಹಾರಿ ಗೋಪಿ ಜನ ವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವಾರಧಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ಬಿಹಾರಿ ಗೋಪಿ ಜನ ವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವರಧಾರಿ ಯಶೋದನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಶೋದನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರ ವನ ಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರ ವನ ಚಾರಿ Krishna Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Krishna Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare ಯ जय प्रभुपदा जय प्रभुपदा जय प्रभुपदा शिल प्रभुपदा प्रभुपा 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 जय जय प्रभुपा 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 जय जय प्रभुपा श्रील प्रभुपाद की ग्रंथा श्रीमद् भागवतम की जय गौर प्रेमानंदी वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Chapter 19, verse number 25. Tatra bhavad bhagavan vyasaputro Tatra bhavad bhagavan vyasaputro Yadrichaya gam atmano napeksha Yadrichaya gam atmano napeksha Alaksha lingo nijalabhatusto Alaksya lingo nijalabhatusto Vritascha balaya avadhuta vesha Vritascha balaya avadhuta vesha Tatra bhavad bhagavan vyasaputro Yadrichaya gam atmano napeksha Alaksha lingo nijalabhatusto Vritascha balaya avadhuta vesha Please repeat. Tatra bhavad bhagavan vyasaputro Yadrichaya gam
Yeah.
Tatra there. Abhavat appeared. Bhagavan powerful. Vyasaputra son of Vyasadeva. Yadrichaya as one desires. Gam the earth. Atamanaha while traveling. Anapeksha disinterested. Alakshya unmanifested. Linga symptoms. Nijalabha self-realized. What is that? For Nijalabha? Okay. All right. Well, this is the online version of the Veda base that I have. So, self-realized. Tushta, satisfied. Vritaha, surrounded. Cha, and. Bale, by children. Avadhuta, neglected by others. Veshaha, dressed. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki jai. At that moment there appeared the powerful son of Vyasadeva, who traveled over the earth disinterested and satisfied with himself. He did not manifest any symptoms of belonging to any social order or status of life. He was surrounded with women and children, and he dressed as if others had neglected him. Purport. The word Bhagavan is sometimes used in relation with some of the great devotees of the Lord, like Sukadev Goswami. Such liberated souls are disinterested in the affairs of this material world because they are self-satisfied by the great achievements of devotional service. As explained before, Sukadev Goswami never accepted any formal spiritual master, nor did he undergo any formal reformatory performances. His father, Vyasadeva, was his natural spiritual master because Sukadev Goswami heard Srimad Bhagavatam from him. After this, he became completely self-satisfied. Thus, he was not dependent on any formal process. The formal processes are necessary for those who are expected to reach the stage of complete liberation. But Sri Sukadev Goswami was already in that status by the grace of his father. As a young boy, he was expected to be properly dressed, but he went about naked and was uninterested in social customs. He was neglected by the general populace, and inquisitive boys and women surrounded him as if he were a madman. He thus appears on the scene while traveling on the earth of his own accord. It appears that upon the inquiry of Maharaj Parikshit, the great sages were not unanimous in their decision as to what was to be done. For spiritual salvation, there were many prescriptions according to the different modes of different persons. But the ultimate aim of life is to attain the highest perfectional stage of devotional service to the Lord. As doctors differ, so also sages differ in their different prescriptions. While such things were going on, the great and powerful son of Vyasadeva appeared on the scene. Om Magyana Timidandasya Dhyananjana Shalakaya Jakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayaham Dadati Sva Padantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tham Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shivishakhanvitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare 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 Krishna. Translation once again. At that moment there appeared the powerful son of Vyasadeva who traveled over the earth disinterested and satisfied with himself. He did not manifest any symptoms of belonging to any social order or status of life. He was surrounded with women and children and he dressed as if others had neglected him. So this is a section where Sukadeva Goswami appears on the scene at the perfect time, perfect place. So just to sort of put this particular verse in context, earlier in chapter 4 of this canto, of canto 1, wow, in chapter 4 of this canto, the sages were having a conversation with Suta Goswami, or they were asking him many, many questions. They asked him, and in the fourth chapter they asked him about three different personalities. They wanted to know about Vyasadeva, they wanted to know about Parikshit Maharaj, and they wanted to know about Sukadeva Goswami and how they all, and the relationship between all three of them. So the question that they asked in the fourth chapter about Vyasadeva was, in what period and at what place was this begun, this whole Bhagavatam? Where did Vyas, the great sage, get the inspiration to compile this literature? So that was one of their questions. How did he get the inspiration to compile this literature? Like, because this is such an amazing piece of work, how does somebody get an inspiration to engage in that work? Because there's always a motivation behind people doing something, right? Maybe you've noticed some great injustice with your family and that inspires you to become a lawyer. Maybe you saw somebody save someone's life and you're like, that would be great to do, so you decide to become a doctor, right? Who knows? There's many reasons behind somebody actually does something in life. And so when we see some greatness, you want to see, like, what was actually, the greatness is great. What was the thing behind that greatness that made that person do that wonderful act, especially in something that's going to benefit so many more people? That's also a beautiful story, isn't it? Like, why? What happened in this person's life that, let's like, we know if when we first learn about the Hare Krishna movement, we have no idea about the person who created the movement. We have no idea about his struggles. And then you learn about the struggles of Srila Prabhupada, and then that movement has so much more meaning after that. So much more depth. After learning about how he grew up, what his challenges were, how he met a spiritual master, how he struggled in Delhi, how he struggled in the Lower East Side, and then, you know, now you walk in, you get a beautiful temple, you get prasadam, you get books, you get devotees, you get festivals, it's like, okay, it's all ready made, ready to go. But the behind the scenes is a lot of times where the nectar is. And the sages at Naimisharanya, they are behind nectar. They chase nectar. Even though they know everything, they're chasing nectar. So that was one of their questions, was what inspired Vyasadeva? Where did he get that motivation from to do this amazing work that's going to benefit and guide humanity for the rest of this yuga, right? And then they wanted to know about Parikshit Maharaj. said, how did it happen that the king met this great sage, making it possible for this great transcendental essence of the Vedas to be sung? He, Sukadeva Goswami, was accustomed to stay at the door of a householder only long enough for a cow to be milked. And he did this just to sanctify the residence. So what's also interesting is, every time the sages inquire about something or a personality, they begin to glorify that personality. So this is a glorification. They're asking about Sukadev Goswami, but they're glorifying him in the way that he only stayed at someone's home and for enough time for a cow to be milked. That's glorification. Like, no attachment, no desire to really come in and make himself comfortable. Doesn't need those resources or facilities. Just wants the milk. Actually, it's not even the milk that he wants. He's there to go give his mercy, and he's allowing them to serve him, right? So the sages, as they inquire, they also simultaneously glorify. So they inquired about Parikshit Maharaj, and here's the glorification of Parikshit Maharaj. He was such a great emperor and possessed all the opulences of his acquired kingdom. He was so exalted that he was increasing the prestige of the Pandu dynasty. Why did he give up everything to sit down on the bank of the Ganges and fast until death? By someone this great, someone this powerful, someone who has everything in life and much more. Like, the billionaires of today can't compare to this, because you rule the whole planet. Like, people want to rule the whole planet, but they're not going to have that chance. So, and then it also explained that he was a support for his citizens. They depended on him. So why did he sit down on the bank of the Ganges to fast until death? So what we're studying now in chapter 19 is an answer to this question right here. Why did he sit down to fast until death? How did he meet the great Sukadev Goswami who wandered the earth? Where did Vyasadeva get the inspiration to compile this great literature? So in the 19th chapter, where we are right now, is the explanation of how Parikshit and Sukadev Goswami met. And this whole chapter is really interesting. You know, there's so many motivational speeches out there, right? On the internet, on Facebook. Everyone's giving a motivational talk. But really, I was thinking about this actually on the car ride here. I was like, this in one sense is the ultimate motivational text. What is a motivational talk? A motivational talk generally entails someone who's going through a struggle and they've learned to overcome it. And that person technically becomes qualified to give a motivational talk. And the greater the struggle, the more popular the talk becomes. The more people listen to it, the more people appreciate it. So the reason I felt that this is the greatest motivational text, it's because it's centered around someone who's about to die. And now, it's not that he overcomes death in our understanding of that. It's not that he doesn't die at the end, because he does die. So it doesn't have a happy ending if we want to look for that happy ending. Because usually a motivational talk, someone who has a happy ending, yes, they struggled, they didn't have anything growing up, and then they were homeless for a while, and their parents were drug addicts, and now they're millionaires. Wow, great. I mean, that is an amazing story, and it is inspiring to hear somebody going through that. But this is a whole different level of motivation. Here is someone who is going to die. He knows he's going to die. And the motivational component of this is not that he conquers death in the material sense, but it's how he decides to deal with that bad news. And what he does going forward after he receives that news. I think that is super and incredibly motivational. Right? And just to help us understand his mindset and why this is motivational. Because generally, when an individual receives bad news, I mean, what to speak of death, any bad news, something bad's going to happen to you, and you know when, you can go into all kinds of anxiety. We're not looking forward to that. We're trying to do everything we can to avoid it. Earlier in this chapter, Maharaj Parikshit's mood and mindset is described. First of all, he's already lamenting that he misbehaved towards that Brahmin boy, or towards that Brahmin, putting a snake around his neck while he was sleep, or in meditation, not sleeping. So here, he thought he was maybe pretending to be in meditation. But Maharaj Parikshit's mood is, earlier in the chapter, the king accepted this as good news, for it would be the cause of his indifference toward worldly things. So he received it as good news. Now, I've never received bad news in a good way. So far, it hasn't happened. I may preach to myself, but all the philosophy I've stuffed into my head over the last couple of decades, but in the end, my mood is still down. I'm still a little depressed that it's going to happen to me. And so I've never received it as good news, because from my perspective, there's nothing really good about it. The good part of it is going to be revealed to us several years later when we reflect back on it and realize all the things we learned from it and all the ways we grew from it. In the moment, it's just pure bad. It's just miserable. And so it takes us a while, weeks, months, years, decades, to look back at something and realize, oh, all of that happened for a really amazing reason, and because of all of that, I am who I am today. And it shaped me into who I am today. But here he is, Parikshit Maharaj, receiving it as good news. That tells you what level he was already at. That tells us he had actually accepted his fate. One reason we suffer a lot in life because we haven't accepted what's happening to us. We haven't fully, deep down inside, accepted that this is what I'm meant to be going through. This is what's meant to be happening to me. Because we haven't embraced it or accepted it, we struggle with it, we fight with it, and in that fight, we get more depressed by it. And it is hard, no matter how much philosophy we stuff into our head, it is hard to accept when things get topsy-turvy in our life. It's just hard to accept that as human beings. And I think even as devotees, we need to be able to just acknowledge that this is hard and I'm not fully accepting this. Why is this happening? I don't know. One thing I should know as a devotee is that he is not to blame. At least that much we should know, that Krishna is not to blame. At least at some point in our spiritual sojourn, we should be able to come to know that it's not Krishna's fault. It's not his doing. Yes, he ultimately turns the key, but we also have a lot of keys that we're turning in our life that are making things that have opened doors to good and bad karma. So at least that is something we need to be able to do, is not blame God for whatever we're going through. So at this point, when he realizes this, we know what happens. He decides he's going to go to the bank of the Ganges, sit down and fast until death. He's made up his mind. He's accepted what's happening in his life. He's accepted that fate, and he's ready to do it. But again, he's not doing it irresponsibly, because he did rule about 60 years before fasting till death. He did rule for many, many decades. And he ruled amazingly, perfectly, as perfect as you can rule, right? A whole planet. He did it. The kingdom was flourishing. People were happy for the most part. There's always going to be some unhappy people no matter what you do. You could be giving out $1 million every day. Some people are still going to be happy. How come he's not giving out two? That's just life. That's just human beings. We're just never going to be fully happy. You watch. If someone started, if the mayor started giving out like $1,000 bills every day, next, in a month, you'll be like, why isn't he giving out two? I guarantee that will go through our mind at some point. Or why isn't he giving out a little bit more? So he put his son on the throne, got things ready, set things up, and then he went to fast until death. Right? So it wasn't premature renunciation. It wasn't just whimsical. It wasn't just an emotional outburst. He had heard one good kirtan, he decided he was going to renounce the world now. Right? He didn't like hear one class and decide that now it's time to... No. It was a thought out, well-planned, organized way that he did it. And so that's an important lesson, that we talk about his renunciation. But we don't talk about the rule. We don't talk about all the things he did in his life to rule the kingdom. I mean, we don't have that much information about it, but he did rule it. I've heard it for decades. He was on the throne for decades, ruling the kingdom, managing the affairs, collecting taxes, fighting wars, fighting off enemies, dealing with his family. We only look at the death part, but we also need to look at the life part. Because we're alive right now. We're not going to have a snake bird bite us in a week. Anything could happen, I know. We're not denying that. But we do need to know how the man lived. Why just talk about his death? It's glorious. His death is glorious. But so was his life. And because we have a life to live, we need to also look at his life. Right? So, I've heard it explained that the Bhagavad Gita is a text for us living in this world because it's spoken on a battlefield, and the Bhagavatam is more for us to die. Interesting perspective. Because it was spoken to Arjuna right before the most difficult battle challenge of his life. Right? It just doesn't get any more difficult than that. So the Gita really tells us to do our duty, be detached from the fruits of our activities. I mean, to some degree, be detached, whether they come or not, be detached from that. When the fruits come, how we use them, that's also important, how we deal with the fruits. It's not that we just give up the fruits. You give up some of it, but you still got to use the fruits to maintain yourself and maintain your family. And use those fruits to serve society. The fruits aren't just meant purely for detachment. We're detached in case they go away, we're detached. But the fruits are meant to nourish us. That's why the fruits are there. You don't plant a tree and just give away all the fruits. You take some, offer them to Krishna, eat them yourself too. Right? We do need to enjoy the fruits. They're there. Krishna gave them to us to enjoy some of the fruits. Our body needs enjoyment. Otherwise, we'll just be depressed. And you're not going to practice much bhakti walking around depressed. And we're not going to be very susukham. We're not going to be very blissful if that happens. So, Parikshit Maharaj received this and he decided to fast until death. And then later in the chapter, see here. And I'd read this before and I never really caught this. It's interesting, it explains that when he came to the Ganges to do his final tapasya, says there were, it wasn't just great sages that had come. It explained that there were also many other saintly demigods, kings, and special royal orders called Arunadayas, a special rank of Rajarshis, from different dynasties of sages. When they all assembled together to meet Emperor Parikshit, he received them properly and bowed his head to the ground. So it's interesting. It wasn't just great sages that came. There were kings there too. They also came. I mean, just see how inspired they were by Parikshit. Like even kings and Rajarshis and demigods came. Like everyone showed up to be with Parikshit in his last moment. And that tells you how well he ruled the kingdom. Right? If you don't like someone and they're dying, you're probably not going to show up. I'm guessing. Maybe you will if you feel like, okay, now it's time to just bury the hatches. Right? So, everyone's showing up. And this is really amazing that People from all realms are showing up. Different parts of the universe are showing up to be with Parikshit Maharaj and to hear Sukadev Goswami speak to him. Because again, these are two saintly people that are coming together for a conversation. Because Parikshit Maharaj is a saintly king and Sukadev Goswami self-realized at birth. Parikshit Maharaj saw the Lord in the womb. So these are not ordinary personalities. When two personalities like that come together naturally, we want to be there if we can. We definitely want to be there and get a front row seat, right? So, and then what I really like is in the 13th verse, he says that, the king says to greet them, he's like, we're most grateful of all the kings who are trained to get favors from the great souls. Generally, you consider royalty as refuse to be rejected and left in a distant place. So what's really amazing is his whole mood is that he welcomes them, even though he's going to die, right? Like, if you think about it, if we're finding out we're going to die or something horrible is going to happen to us, if a guest shows up, it's going to be hard to really receive them properly. Like, you're so absorbed in your own misery and what's about to happen. How can you really pleasantly welcome someone? Think about someone else. But he welcomed them. He bowed down to them. And now he's glorifying them that I'm grateful that you've all come. Generally, you don't like to associate with royalty. Right? So he's really, really grateful. And then, in the 17th verse, it is explained that Maharaj Parikshit sat down, and he said that sat down with straw roots facing the east, placed on the southern banks of the Ganges, and he himself faced the north. Just previously, he had given charge of his kingdom over to his son. So much we can learn from this, that he wasn't overly attached to the kingdom. Because, you know, at that moment, in a difficult moment like that, we would all just want to be as comfortable as possible. Like, okay, the snake bird is going to bite me. Never seen one of them, but it's going to bite me because I was cursed, so it's going to show up somehow, somewhere. And it's going to bite me, so I want to be comfortable. What most kings would do, they would get an army together, they'd lock themselves up in their house, and say, okay, get the army together, surround the palace, have another army outside of my bedroom door, and probably another army inside the bedroom with him. Like, okay, I'm good to go now. Like, I'm good to go. So, I think that this is how most people, or if a king who had that much facility, would probably respond. Right? Like, from what I understand, in the White House, there is like a chamber at the bottom where the president would go to if there's like a bomb threat. Some place where like no bomb can penetrate that. I mean, and maybe Parikshit Maharaj did have that. Maybe he did as a king, as a proper ruler. You got to have ways to get out and save yourself because you're the king. You manage everything. Without king, there's chaos. Maybe he had that. But he knew that this is not the time he's going to use that bomb shelter. Right? He's not going to use that. And he just gave it all up. And so that also shows that he had prepared himself throughout his life in the middle of all of this management that he was involved in. He had taken the time to prepare his consciousness for that unpredictable and most unpleasant moment. He prepared himself for that. And because he was thoroughly prepared, he was able to do the right thing. And again, he was able to do the right thing in a very responsible way. In a very responsible way. And then, he was able to do this in a peaceful way, it's explained. Just, you know, he did his responsibilities throughout his life. And so therefore, he was actually able to do this in a very peaceful way, with his mind fixed on the goal of life. Because if our material life isn't stable, it's going to be hard for us at any point in our life, what to speak at the time of death, to really focus on the real goal of life. The real goal of life is here, and we have so many material duties on the way to that goal of life. And we are working on that goal of life every single day. We are working on it every day. But we need to make sure that there are other immediate goals of life that we have to deal with. That may be getting an education, that may be getting a job, that may be getting married, having kids, setting your kids up. All of these things are our immediate duties, and we remember the goal of life as we're doing this. And that's the thing what Krishna told Arjuna on the battlefield in the 8th chapter. He's like, you need to remember the Supreme Lord while doing your duty, while doing it. So while you're fighting, while you're killing, when you get those moments, you got to remember what the goal of life is. So here, in the 18th verse, thus Parikshit Maharaj sat to fast until death. All the demigods of the higher planets praised the king's actions and in pleasure continually scattered flowers over the earth and beat celestial drums. So he was blessed. He had done all of his spiritual, religious, material duties. And I found this, and I thought this was really interesting because I'd never really thought of it this way. It talks about, let's see here, that news of Maharaj Parikshit's fasting unto death to attain salvation reached the higher planets in the sky where the intelligent demigods live. But that news went up there. And it explained that the demigods are more luxurious than human beings. But all of them are obedient to the orders of the Supreme Lord. There is no one in the heavenly planets who is an atheist or non-believer. I mean, they're amazing devotees, actually. And so what else is really interesting here? So it's explained that they honored him by showering flowers upon him. And it explains that Prabhupada says that a demigod takes pleasure in seeing someone go back to Godhead. And that's really amazing. Like, there are well-wishers. Says, he is always pleased with a devotee of the Lord, so much so that by his adidevic powers, by divine powers, he may help the devotee in all respects. And by their actions, the Lord is pleased with them. So it's really interesting that they can't give us liberation. The devatas, the demigods, can't give us liberation, because only Krishna can give that to us. But they can help us on that journey, right? He's like, takes pleasure in seeing someone go back to Godhead, so much so that by his adidevic powers, he may help the devotees. So I think we all know that going back to Godhead is no easy task. It's not an easy task. And it's hard to say how long each one of us has been on this journey, like how many lifetimes, how many yugas, how many manvantars? How long actually we've been like swimming in this ocean of birth and death trying to get there? And we can't get there on our own. We really do need help. And I just never kind of caught this, that the demigods are also trying to help us. But help comes if we ask for it, right? And then here, the last line of the purport, Prabhupada said, there is an invisible chain of complete cooperation between the Lord, the demigods, and the devotees of the Lord on earth. And I was just thinking, like, what does that mean? There's an invisible chain, like between the Lord, the demigods, and the devotees on earth. There is a chain, right? Like in the 3rd chapter of the Gita, Krishna says that he created the men and the demigods, and that by cooperation between the two, there'll be success for everyone. So it's just something to think about, that we have a lot of help available to us in the form of sadhu, shastra, right, guru. But we have so much help. And why aren't we taking more advantage of this help? All of this help is there for us to actually go back to Godhead. And if we see it in that way, we can really, you know, if something, if you know someone has connections in the field that you're trying to progress in, you would definitely hit that person up for some connections. Like, hey, can you hook me up with that person? We should take advantage of whatever we can to get ahead. And for us, we want to get ahead in spiritual life. So why not take advantage of that? And then it's so beautiful how much everybody who came there loved Parikshit Maharaj. And this verse explains how much they loved him. It says, verse 21, I really like this verse. The sages are saying to Parikshit, we shall all wait here until the foremost devotee of the Lord, Maharaj Parikshit, returns to the supreme planet. I mean, they're like, we're going to be here with you until you leave. Like, we're not leaving until you've gone. You've finished your mission on this earth. Can you imagine, like, how much love they have for him? How nicely he did things. He made sure that the sages and the brahmanas were able to perform their yajnas, that they were able to do that. And they're so grateful to him. They have so much love for him. You know, their love was probably just going to send him back to Godhead. If you think about it, when you have thousands of saintly people and demigods and everyone loving you, you're already back. It's just a formality. He has to listen to Sukadev Goswami just for our benefit. He's already back. I mean, he was back to Godhead while he was in the womb because he saw Vishnu. So it's just amazing that when I read this verse, I was like, wow, they're all just going to wait there for him to leave. Thousands of people, tens of thousands. We don't know how many people came together, but there was a lot. And then, of course, in the 24th verse, the previous verse, is he asked that famous question. What is the duty of everyone in all circumstances, especially for those who are about to die? Because that is his present situation. That is his current situation. And I'm sure if he was about to go into another battle, he might ask, what is the best strategy for this battle? According to time, place, circumstance. If he needed to raise his children properly, I'm sure he would ask counsel on how to do that. But right now, in this moment, so the point is, at each time in our life, we will need help from people more experienced than us. Whatever that may be. And it's important, and even though he is self-realized, he's asking this question. He's actually more advanced than a lot of the sages that were present there. Because they weren't all personalists. There were some impersonalists there. Great, elevated impersonalists. He was actually on a higher level than a lot of people that were actually there. Yet, in his humility, he's asking for help. And so as we go through life, there are going to be situations where we're going to need help. And we shouldn't be afraid to ask for it. And then today's verse, Sukadev Goswami appears on the scene, and unanimously everyone agrees that he's the one who should be answering Maharaj Parikshit's question about what should a man do who's about to die. Because Sukadev Goswami is in one sense completely disconnected. He's dead to the world in one sense. And he's fully elevated. He didn't have to go through any of the processes that a normal child has to go through. He's unique. Doesn't mean that our children shouldn't go through that. They absolutely should go through all the processes that are needed to get the blessings of the sages, the demigods, the parents, the forefathers. We should get as many blessings as we can. Nothing wrong with getting blessings. Blessings are great. Whoever they're coming from, we should get them. Right? They're there for us. Krishna made the arrangement for us to get gazillions of blessings, and we should take them all. Because we're going to need every single one of them. Because life is going to throw so many speed bumps in our way. And if we don't slow, sometimes we won't see the speed bump coming. And then your car like launches a little bit, right? You're like, oh my gosh, I didn't see that one coming. And so here, the last thing I kind of want to mention is, at the very end of the purport, Prabhupada says, as doctors differ, so also sages differ. in their different prescriptions. With such things, while such things were going on, the great and powerful son of Vyasadeva appeared on the scene. So the different sages, according to their training, had different ideas of what might be the best thing for him to do. Right? And we know that everybody has opinions, right? Lawyers will have different opinions, doctors will have different opinions, and accountants will have different opinions of how you should manage your books and everything. So there's so many opinions. Even in spiritual life, there's so many opinions, aren't there? And so that can be tricky. What to speak of disagreements and different philosophy? Even the Supreme Lord disagrees with himself. Do you know what I'm talking? Which pastime I'm talking about? When Bhima and Duryodhan were about to get into a battle after the war was over, Duryodhan was hiding in the lake. Forget the name of the lake. He was hiding in the lake, underneath. I mean, he was a great yogi. He was sitting under there, under the lake, just breathing and just hiding out. Finally, everybody found out that Duryodhan's in this lake, and they knew that they needed to get rid of him to really officially finish the battle. Otherwise, he could continue to create mischief. They went there. Yudhishthira Maharaj says, out of his enthusiasm, Duryodhan, come out and you can fight any one of us. And if you win, you can have the whole kingdom. And of course, Bhima, Krishna, and Arjuna, again, put their hands on their head like, what is he saying now? He just speaks without thinking. Lord, aren't we in this mess because he said all of the things he said and did all the things he did? Here he is giving it all up again after we just won the battle. Anyways, Duryodhan couldn't let go of the fact that Bhima is the one who killed all of his 99 brothers. And so he's like, okay, I'll fight Bhima. Before the fight begins, who walks in? Lord Balaram. And now, it's interesting, even in that moment, Balaram is taking sides with Duryodhana. It's unbelievable. It's the Supreme Personality of God. And the Lord is very interesting. We're never going to understand him. And the Lord Balaram actually starts mildly. He's like, so is this really going to happen here? Is this appropriate? Is this fair? And Krishna's like, fair? Like, what do you mean fair? You do realize what's just happened, hasn't it? And then Krishna gave him the whole story of what just happened. Balaram's like, yeah, I know. Balaram's like, you're a tricky talker, and I know you're convincing me, but I'm not fully convinced that, I mean, you're like, when you read that conversation, you just can't believe that Balaram is saying this. You have to remind yourself, this is God, and this is like their interesting Leela. So they actually have a whole disagreement. Krishna's disagreeing, but Balaram does back down. He backs down by saying, well, you're going to say what you're going to say. He doesn't like fully believe him. Actually, fully doesn't believe him. You're going to say what you're going to say. You're going to convince whoever you want to convince. But he doesn't feel like that what's about to happen is going to happen, is right. I mean, he supported Bhima, Duryodhan. He supported the other's side multiple times during the Mahabharata. So there are disagreements. And spiritual life is going to have those disagreements. And it's up to our own maturity and intelligence to not get caught up in that. Like the play between Advaita Acharya and Lord Nityananda. Right? It's Vishnu against Vishnu. Vishnu Tattva and Vishnu Tattva are going at it, playing with each other, criticizing each other. And here we have it again. Vishnu Tattva is having a conversation with himself and disagreeing. So, all I can say, this is just the inconceivable beauty of our, theology. You can only smile at it, appreciate it, and say, I'm never getting any of this stuff. Hopefully, somehow, I'll be able to just have a little bit more devotion. So, there's going to be so many differing opinions. And for me, the way I deal with it, I'm like, well, when I hear debates or conversations, I'm like, I'm just trying to chant my round somehow. I'm like, I'm just trying to get my 16 rounds done, and I'm trying to see if I can hear a couple mantras in each round. If I can do that, if I can do my rounds perfectly, then maybe I'll listen to some debates. I don't know. If I can just do what I'm trying to do, I'm satisfied with that. So I think we all have a different way of dealing with it. Some of us can get really sucked in by debates and philosophical. I mean, for me, I'm like, I just got to try to chant my rounds, and that's it. and just try to associate with devotees and try not to offend anyone today. If I can do that, I think I'm good, and let everyone else have their own discussion. So anyways, these were some of my thoughts on today's verse, and I want to see if there's any comments or questions.
Thank you for a really interesting class. Appreciate it. One thing that struck me that you said was everybody, all the devotees, everybody there loved Maharaj Prakrit, you know? So in one sense, he was already there, you know? If the devotees love you that much, you've got so many blessings that you're back to Godhead. So I was thinking it's kind of a nice barometer for ourselves, you know, to understand if we have nice relationships with the devotees, with each other, that how many blessings you receive, because oftentimes there's so many things can happen, you know, words exchanged, unpleasant, and how to tolerate, how to fix it, you know. But I really liked that. Another question I had, actually two questions. One of them was like with the demigods, so, you know, that cooperation between the Lord and the devotees and the demigods, and you mentioned... And you mentioned that, you know, the demigods can help us. So once, you know, I thought, okay, the young girls who were praying to Goddess Katyayani for Krishna to be their husband, but how would we use that in that same way, where we would be praying to the demigods, oh, Goddess Saraswati, please give me the intelligence to be able to, you know, preach nicely, or, you know, what, Goddess Lakshmi, that you would pray, oh, please give me the wealth that I'd be able to use in Krishna's service. I'm just wondering what your vision is on that.
So, you know, I feel like there are many resources. First of all, I think the first aspect is gratitude, right? We've been given so much by so many people. The basic thing is to at least express gratitude. If someone helps me, someone feeds me, someone educates me, someone teaches me, we at least say thank you to our teachers, to our parents, to our siblings, to our friends. And what about like sunlight? Like Hari Bol, 24/7? Is any friend there 24/7 for us? Sunlight, what about the air? What about the rain? I mean, what about knowledge? Right? There's even a verse where we chant the verse of Devi Saraswati Vyasa. Right? I mean, there's a verse in the Bhagavatam, Mother Saraswati, right? So we're getting so much already. We're being served by them every day, right? The wind, the air, in ways we can't. I mean, I've even heard, right? Like there's every part of our body is being controlled by some demigod. So it's like we're surviving. It's like me taking from you every day and not once thinking to do something for you. Like me coming into your house every day, eating your food, right? And just walking out every day. So if nothing else, I think on the minimum, maybe once in a while, like, well, thank you for the sunlight. Thank you, Surya, for being there. I mean, he was the first to hear the Bhagavad Gita from Krishna, so he's obviously a special being, right? Fourth chapter, Krishna says, our first instructor is the sun god. So he's doing it every day. And so, I don't know, it's just about consciousness. It's just about awareness. All the people that are helping us in our Krishna consciousness. You know, we may drift away from some of the people that helped us initially, but I know I have, but I still think of them or what they did for me. I'm still grateful. Some of them have even fallen away, but I'm still grateful for what they did and who they are. So, and I think that the devatas gets, I would say, severely neglected, and they're serving us 24/7. It's like parents get neglected all the time by their kids. They're serving 24/7, right? A lot of kids are just like, oh, well, whatever. It's like, you know, take them for granted. So I think that's on the basic level, it's there. And I think on a higher level, as long as we know our, you know, the offense to the holy name is to think of them as independent. Offering respect and worship is not an offense. It's to think of them as the same as the Supreme Lord. That's the offense. So I can thank you for all you do for serving me, and then if I offer you some service back, that really pleases your heart. But I see you as a representative of Prabhupada, as a representative of the Parampara. I don't see you as Prabhupada. Right? So I think if we see everything in the right way, I feel like there's a lot of blessings we could be missing out on. Because they have incredible blessings and powers to bestow upon us. So, you know, yeah, if you do need to pray and ask for blessings, for your, if you, why do we get a master's degree after a bachelor's? Why do we get a PhD? Why do we have to, you know, take on a mentor at that point? Because we need their help to get higher, to higher levels, to be able to be more comfortable in this material world, right? People worship their PhD mentors, their professors. They have to, kind of, you know, to get, you have to, like, to get, you know, for them to, like, you know, bestow their benedictions upon you. So if we're seeking blessings and benefits from the material world, why not some blessings for our material progress if we need it, for our health, for stability? Why not? Because if that stability helps me worship Krishna more, because when we have too much instability, even worshiping Krishna is hard. You could be doing an arati and all you're thinking about is your problem that you're going through and you can't overcome. So if we can get some stability, and we struggle for stability in this material world like anything, and we do, that's what, we get jobs, we try to get promotions. Why are we trying to get promotions? Because we want to be more stable. But if there's ways to get stability, as long as the goal is clear to worship Krishna and his devotees, then I think there's no harm. It's just the right consciousness and the mood in which we do it. Gratitude is the beginning stage, I think.
That's great, thanks. And one other question, just when you referred to elevated impersonalists. So I know that, you know, I've heard it before. I don't totally understand it, just because Prabhupada was so, you know, upset with impersonalists. You know, with many instances where he was, you know, in a situation, and like devotees started glorifying a Bhagavad Gita that was kind of impersonal, probably got so mad and slammed it down. Or, you know, being in a big lecture hall and someone got up and started preaching impersonalism, and Prabhupada immediately start the kirtan, you know. So how does that work? It seems like we have an oxymoron. You have an elevated impersonalist.
Well, the people who showed up to hear this conversation were elevated, right? Like, these aren't the kind of people Prabhupada was, like, you know, started doing kirtan in front of.
So it's a different kind of impersonal?
I mean, I think these are very elevated beings. For them to be in the presence of Sukadev Goswami Parikshit Maharaj, and the demigods are there too. So I think the gathering of sages here, you know, there's different levels of impersonalists, and I don't know the difference exactly enough to talk about it, but like the Brahma bodies, the Maya bodies, the Brahma bodies are sort of neutral, I believe, towards, again, I could be a little bit wrong here, about their understanding who the Supreme Lord is, whereas the Maya bodies completely reject that. But the fact that they showed up, you know, even Maya bodies, like the high level ones, can be liberated beings, that they're beyond the bodily platform. They can do all kinds of mystic things with their mind and body. Like, they could travel, they can do a lot of that. They're just not going back to God, you know? They're going to be floating around the world for a while, like they'll fall down maybe and become philanthropists or something, like Prabhupada explained. So they are the elevated ones, elevated not spiritually,
right,
not bhakti-wise elevated, but their mind is just like, they can go anywhere in the universe if they want to. They can do all of that mystical stuff. It's just that they're going to hit a wall when it comes to, like, the wall between the spiritual world and the material world. That's their glass ceiling. They're not going beyond that. But they can traverse the rest of it pretty amazingly and do miracles, right?
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
We hear a lot about these great, great souls that didn't act at all according to structures that we know, like Sukadev going naked and so many stories, you know, acting fools or... So I was wondering, in the structure that we function as Vaishnav, you know, we some Vaishnav, they can sit in a class, so we know that they know better than some others or whatever, the structure. Is it going to stop us from seeing a pure soul coming in the temple one day?
I didn't fully understand the
I mean that the structures that we're in, you know, that certain behaviors are the way that we should act in Vedic ways. Mm-hmm. Is it going to stop us from seeing that pure soul that is not at all behaving in the way that we used to see elevated people in Krishna consciousness?
I think the structure is going to do exactly, it's going to exactly help us see the elevated beings. Because structure means studying the scripture, understanding what the behavior, traditional behavior is of an elevated being, and the scripture will also tell us the exceptional, the exception to the rule, which is Sukadev, or Bharat, Jad Bharat, right? Or sometimes whatever Lord Nityananda does. So there are always exceptions to the rule, so we have to be well-versed in scripture to know that a majority, like Vyasadeva, will be like in the Vyasadeva category, like, you know, when Sukadeva Goswami walked by, you know, the ladies who were bathing didn't care when he walked by. So like, mostly it's going to be like Vyasadeva type category. But once in a while, you're going to have that avadut who's just not interested. It's just so removed. And then we may not still be able to recognize who that is, but we, in our mind we can assume maybe that if they're doing something strange, maybe they're elevated, who knows, right? We don't know. So, but I think the study can give us, will help us understand to some degree, a decent degree, who's who.
Because every day that reality of spiritual knowledge and life is going on right now. It's not just something that is in the past. So that great soul may walk into our temple also.
Yeah. Thank you. So I think we'll take one more question. Oh, well, all right. We'll do two.
About the Mayavadis, Prabhupada would get very angry, and of course, because they're not really like what we're talking about, the impersonalists.
Yeah. Exactly.
These people, they preach to the masses, you know, we're all God, and, you know, they misinterpret the Bhagavad Gita.
They were a whole different category. Yeah. They were accumulating
followers.
They don't
even know.
Yeah, it's just like becoming famous.
We're him, he's us, we're all God. You can worship anybody. It's so common.
Yeah.
And they've spoiled all of India. Everybody has, you know, they...
And then they would have a few.
Durga is there, everyone's there. I wish.
And then the news would reveal that they have like a couple of girlfriends sometimes because they're God, and you know, it's like, so yeah, that's the, I think that's what he was really angry about.
Yeah, and drinking tea, coffee, everything.
Behind the scenes, it's a whole different person.
And then the worst thing is they teach the masses like that, and people listen, you know, on the big TV channels, and you know, they like it very much. And there's Hare Krishna's, we have so many rules, don't eat this, don't do this.
Yeah.
You know, only Krishna's. So. People like that kind of, and they've spoiled us. Prabhupada would get very angry. His Guru Maharaj also.
Within that
succession.
All right, one more comment or question, and then we'll conclude for the day.
You got a bunch online too here, but anyways, I got the mic. Suka Prabhu's, Mataji Prabhu Maharaj's question there about the Mayavadis. I mean, there was also a specific cultural dynamic in the early days of the movement where a Mayavadi interpretation of the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita was culturally dominant, not just in the West, but in India. And then you had all these young devotees like, do I listen to Radha Krishna or do I listen to Prabhupada? I mean, there's no well-established Bhakti tradition as a lens to look at all that stuff. So when you're dealing with, you know, like young kids who don't know what to do, it's just do this and don't worry about the rest. You know, having said that, a Mayavadi is a little bit different animal than a straight up impersonalist perhaps, where they're really trying to draw out a meaning where you could become God, and then the whole aspect of a relationship with Krishna is like this marginal neophyte thing that gets you, you know, it's sort of adverse. It's actually, as opposed to just, you know, I'm grooving on the Brahman, but I'm open to whatever. You know, so I remember Dwaitacharya, who grew up in Mathura, some such place, was saying as a kid, it was just even there, wherever he was in India, it was really dominant, this Mayavadi interpretation of everything, you know? And it's really with Prabhupada that you know, this sort of cultural momentum has shifted in his lifetime. So that was also perhaps a specific cultural dynamic that we were experiencing.
Granthraj, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki, Srila Prabhupada, Ki, Radha Shyam Sundar Ki.